Chapter 11. Dobbin of ours, Cuff's fight with Dobbin, and the unexpected issue of that contest, will long be remembered by every man who was educated at Dr. Swishtail's famous school. The latter youth, who used to be called A.O. Dobbin, G.O. Dobbin, and by many other names indicative of puerile contempt, was the quietest, the clumsiest, and, as it seemed, the dullest of all Dr. Swishtail's young gentlemen. His parent was a grocer in the city, and it was bruited abroad that he was admitted into Dr. Swishtail's academy upon what are called mutual principles, that is to say, the expenses of his board and schooling were defrayed by his father in goods, not money. And he stood there most at the bottom of the school in his scraggy corduroys and jacket, through the seams of which his great big bones were bursting as the representative of so many pounds of tea, candles, sugar, mottled soap, plums, of which a very mild proportion was supplied for the puddings of the establishment, and other commodities. A dreadful day it was for young Dobbin, when one of the youngsters of the school, having run into the town upon a poaching excursion for hardbake and polonies, espied the cart of Dobbin and Rudge, grocers, and oilmen, Thames Street, London, at the doctor's door, discharging a cargo of the wares in which the firm dealt. Young Dobbin had no peace after that. The jokes were frightful and merciless against him. "Hello, Dobbin," one wag would say, "here's good news in the paper. Sugar's as risses, my boy." Another would say that some F.A. pound of mutton candles cost 7 pence halfpenny, "how much must Dobbin cost?" And a roar would follow from all the circle of young knaves, usher and all, who rightly considered that the selling of goods by retail is a shameful and infamous practice, meriting the contempt and scorn of all real gentlemen. "Your father's only a merchant, Osborne," Dobbin said in private to the little boy who had brought down the storm upon him. At which the latter replied haughtily, "My father's a gentleman, and keeps his carriage." And Mr. William Dobbin retreated to a remote outhouse in the playground, where he passed a half-holiday in the bitterest sadness and woe. Who amongst us is there that does not recollect similar hours of bitter, bitter childish grief? Who feels injustice? Who shrinks before a slight? Who has a sense of wrong so acute, and so glowing a gratitude for kindness, as a generous boy? And how many of those gentle souls do you degrade, estrange, torture, for the sake of a little loose arithmetic, and miserable dog Latin? Now, William Dobbin, from an incapacity to acquire the rudiments of the above language, as they are propounded in that wonderful book The Eton Latin Grammar, was compelled to remain among the very last of Dr. Swishtail's scholars, and was akin down continually by little fellows with pink faces and pinafores, when he marched up with the lower form, a giant amongst them, with his downcast, stupefied look, his dog's-eared primer, and his tight corduroys. High and low, all made fun of him. They sewed up those corduroys, tight as they were. They cut his bed strings. They upset buckets and benches, so that he might break his shins over them, which he never failed to do. They sent him parcels, which, when opened, were found to contain the paternal soap and candles. There was no little fellow, but had his jeer and joke at Dobbin, and he bore everything quite patiently, and was entirely dumb and miserable. Cuff, on the contrary, was the great chief and dandy of the Swishtail Seminary. He smuggled wine in. He fought the town boys. Ponies used to come for him to ride home on Saturdays. He had his top boots in his room, in which he used to hunt in the holidays. He had a gold repeater, and took snuff like the doctor. He had been to the opera, and knew the merits of the principal actors, preferring Mr. Keane to Mr. Kemble. He could knock you off 40 Latin verses in an hour. He could make French poetry. What else didn't he know, or couldn't he do? They said even the doctor himself was afraid of him. Cuff, the unquestioned king of the school, ruled over his subjects, and bullied them, with splendid superiority. This one blacked his shoes. that toasted his bread. Others would fag out and give him balls at cricket during whole summer afternoons. Icks was the fellow whom he despised most, and with whom, though always abusing him and sneering at him, he scarcely ever condescended to hold personal communication. One day in private, the two young gentlemen had had a difference. Fix, alone in the schoolroom, was blundering over a home letter, when Cuff, entering, bade him go upon some message, of which tarts were probably the subject. "I can't," says Dobbin. "I want to finish my letter." "You can't?" says Mr. Cuff, laying hold of that document in which many words were scratched out, many were misspelled, on which had been spent I don't know how much thought, and labor, and tears. For the poor fellow was writing to his mother, who was fond of him, although she was a grocer's wife, and lived in a back parlor in Thames Street. "Who can't?" says Mr. Cuff colon "I should like to know why, pray? Can't he write to old Mother Fix tomorrow?" "Don't call names," Dobbin said, getting off the bench very nervous. "Well, sir, will you go?" crowed the cock of the school. "Put down the letter," Dobbin replied. "No gentleman read the letter." "Well, now will you go?" says the other. "No, I won't." "Don't strike, or I'll THMASH you," roars out Dobbin, springing to a leaden inkstand, and looking so wicked that Mr. Cuff paused, turned down his coat sleeves again, put his hands into his pockets, and walked away with a sneer. But he never meddled personally with the grocer's boy after that, though we must do him the justice to say he always spoke of Mr. Dobbin with contempt behind his back. Some time after this interview, it happened that Mr. Cuff, on a sunshiny afternoon, was in the neighborhood of poor William Dobbin, who was lying under a tree in the playground, spelling over a favorite copy of the Arabian Nights which he had apart from the rest of the school, who were pursuing their various sports quite lonely and almost happy. If people would but leave children to themselves, if teachers would cease to bully them, if parents would not insist upon directing their thoughts and dominating their feelings, those feelings and thoughts which are a mystery to all, for how much do you and I know of each other, of our children, of our fathers, of our neighbor, and how far more beautiful and sacred are the thoughts of the poor lad or girl whom you govern likely to be than those of the dull and world-corrupted person who rules him. If, I say, parents and masters would leave their children alone a little more, small harm would accrue, although a less quantity of as in present I might be acquired. Well, William Dobbin had for once forgotten the world, and was away with Sindbad the sailor in the Valley of Diamonds, or with Prince Ahmed and the fairy Peribanu in that delightful cavern, where the prince found her, and whither we should all like to make a tour, when shrill cries, as of a little fellow weeping, woke up his pleasant reverie, and looking up, he saw Cuff before him, belabouring a little boy. It was the lad who had peached upon him about the grocer's cart, but he bore little malice, not at least towards the young and small. "How dare you, sir, break the bottle?" says Cuff to the little urchin, swinging a yellow cricket stump over him. The boy had been instructed to get over the playground wall at a selected spot, where the broken glass had been removed from the top, and niches made convenient in the brick, to run a quarter of a mile, to purchase a pint of rum shrub on credit, to brave all the doctor's outlying spies, and to clamber back into the playground again, during the performance of which feat, his foot had slipped, and the bottle was broken, and the shrub had been spilled, and his pantaloons had been damaged, and he appeared before his employer a perfectly guilty and trembling, though harmless, wretch. "How dare you, sir, break it?" says Cuff. "You blundering little thief. You drank the shrub, and now you pretend to have broken the bottle. Hold out your hand, sir." Down came the stump with a great heavy thump on the child's hand. A moan followed. Dobbin looked up. The fairy Peribanu had fled into the inmost cavern with Prince Ahmed. The rock had whisked away Sindbad the sailor out of the Valley of Diamonds, out of sight, far into the clouds. And there was everyday life before honest William, and a big boy beating a little one without cause. Hold out your other hand, sir, roars Cuff to his little schoolfellow, whose face was distorted with pain. Dobbin quivered, and gathered himself up in his narrow old clothes. Take that, you little devil, cried Mr. Cuff, and down came the wicket again on the child's hand. Don't be horrified, ladies, every boy at a public school has done it. Your children will so do and be done by, in all probability. Down came the wicket again, and Dobbin started up. I can't tell what his motive was. Torture in a public school is as much licensed as the knout in Russia. It would be ungentlemanlike, in a manner, to resist it. Perhaps Dobbin's foolish soul revolted against that exercise of tyranny, or perhaps he had a hankering feeling of revenge in his mind, and longed to measure himself against that splendid bully and tyrant, who had all the glory, pride, pomp, circumstance, banners flying, drums beating, guards saluting, in the place. Whatever may have been his incentive, however, up he sprang, and screamed out, Hold off, Cuff! Don't bully that child any more, or you'll what? Cuff asked in amazement at this interruption. Hold out your hand, you little beast. I'll give you the worst thrashing you ever had in your life, Dobbin said, in reply to the first part of Cuff's sentence. And little Osborne, gasping and in tears, looked up with wonder and incredulity at seeing this amazing champion put up suddenly to defend him, while Cuff's astonishment was scarcely less. Fancy our late monarch George III, when he heard of the revolt of the North American colonies. Fancy brazen Goliath when little David stepped forward and claimed a meeting, and you have the feelings of Mr. Reginald Cuff when this rencontre was proposed to him. After school, says he, of course, after a pause and a look, as much as to say, make your will, and communicate your last wishes to your friends between this time and that. As you please, Dobbin said. Who must be my bottle holder, Osborne? Well, if you like, little Osborne replied. For you see his papa kept a carriage, and he was rather ashamed of his champion. Yes, when the hour of battle came, he was almost ashamed to say, go it, fix, and not a single other boy in the place uttered that cry for the first two or three rounds of this famous combat, at the commencement of which the scientific Cuff, with a contemptuous smile on his face, and as light and as gay as if he was at a ball, planted his blows upon his adversary, and floored that unlucky champion three times running. At each fall there was a cheer, and everybody was anxious to have the honor of offering the conqueror a knee. What a licking I shall get when it's over, young Osborne thought, picking up his man. Who'd best give in, he said to Dobbin. It's only a thrashing, fix, and you know I'm used to it. But fix, all whose limbs were in a quiver, and whose nostrils were breathing rage, put his little bottle holder aside, and went in for a fourth time. As he did not in the least know how to parry the blows that were aimed at himself, and Cuff had begun the attack on the three preceding occasions, without ever allowing his enemy to strike, Fix now determined that he would commence the engagement by a charge on his own part, and accordingly, being a left-handed man, brought that arm into action, and hit out a couple of times with all his might once at Mr. Cuff's left eye, and once on his beautiful Roman nose. Cuff went down this time, to the astonishment of the assembly. Well hit, by Jove, says little Osborne, with the air of a connoisseur, clapping his man on the back. Gee, give it him with the left, Fix, my boy. Fix left made terrific play during all the rest of the combat. Cuff went down every time. At the sixth round, there were almost as many fellows shouting out, Go it, Fix, as there were youths exclaiming, Go it, Cuff. At the 12th round the latter champion was all abroad, as the saying is, and had lost all presence of mind and power of attack or defense. Fix, on the contrary, was as calm as a Quaker. His face being quite pale, his eyes shining open, and a great cut on his underlip bleeding profusely, gave this young fellow a fierce and ghastly air, which perhaps struck terror into many spectators. Nevertheless, his intrepid adversary prepared to close for the 13th time. If I had the pen of a Napier, or a Bell's Life, I should like to describe this combat properly. It was the last charge of the guard, that is, it would have been, only Waterloo had not yet taken place. It was Ney's column breasting the hill of La Haye Sainte, bristling with 10,000 bayonets, and crowned with 20 eagles. It was the shout of the beefeating British, as leaping down the hill they rushed to hug the enemy in the savage arms of battle. In other words, Cuff coming up full of pluck, but quite reeling and groggy, the fig merchant put in his left as usual on his adversary's nose, and sent him down for the last time. I think that will do for him, Fig said, as his opponent dropped as neatly on the green as I have seen Jack Spot's ball plump into the pocket at billiards. And the fact is, when time was called, Mr. Reginald Cuff was not able, or did not choose, to stand up again. And now all the boys set up such a shout for Fix as would have made you think he had been their darling champion through the whole battle, and as absolutely brought Dr. Swishtail out of his study, curious to know the cause of the uproar. He threatened to flog Fix violently, of course, but Cuff, who had come to himself by this time, and was washing his wounds, stood up and said, "It's my fault, sir, not Fix, not Dobbins. I was bullying a little boy, and he served me right." By which magnanimous speech he, not only saved his conqueror a whipping, but got back all his ascendancy over the boys which his defeat had nearly cost him. Young Osborne wrote home to his parents an account of the transaction. Sugarcane House, Richmond, March, 18. Dear Mama, I hope you are quite well. I should be much obliged to you to send me a cake and 5 shillings. There has been a fight here between Cuff and Dobbin. Cuff, you know, was the cock of the school. They fought 13 rounds, and Dobbin licked. So Cuff is now only second cock. The fight was about me. Cuff was licking me for breaking a bottle of milk, and Fix wouldn't stand it. We call him Fix, because his father is a grocer. Fix and Rudge, Thames Saint, City. I think as he fought for me, you ought to buy your tea and sugar at his father's. Cuff goes home every Saturday, but can't this, because he has 2 black eyes. He has a white pony, to come and fetch him, and a groom in livery on a bay mare. I wish my papa would let me have a pony, and I am your dutiful son, George Sedley Osborne, P.S.S. Give my love to little Emmy. I am cutting her out a coach in cardboard. Please not a seed cake, but a plum cake. In consequence of Dobbin's victory, his character rose prodigiously in the estimation of all his schoolfellows, and the name of Fix, which had been a byword of reproach, became as respectable and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.